We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Children always have the ability to surprise us. That's maybe one of the great things about being a parent. Of course, some of these surprises are not always pleasant. Sometimes when kids are angry or they're having a bad day, they can act out in ways that can be harmful to others, can be, in fact, harmful for themselves. The technical term among psychologists and educators for this is challenging behavior, and dealing with it when children are young can make a big difference to their future development. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about what parents and professionals can do to help children with disabilities, particularly who show these challenging behaviors. And our guest for the program is David Richman. He now has, for a number of years, been associate professor of special education here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and he is on his way to Texas, to Texas Tech, where he will take up the chair position at the Burkhardt Center for Autism Education and Research and continue the kind of work that he's been doing here at the University of Illinois. Particularly, he's interested in autism and in working with children who have autism and also working with parents and teachers of kids who have autism. Questions are welcome as we move through the hour. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. People can also send emails if you'd like to join us that way. You can write to will-talk. That's kind of like it sounds, will-talk@illinois.edu, and we'd be happy to have your input that way. Thank you very much for being here.
David, I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk with you and your listeners.
Appreciate it. Let's just talk about, give us a basic definition of what challenging behavior is.
Well, you know, the term has changed over the years. It used to be referred to as aberrant, or some people pronounce it aberrant. Some people then moved on and called it problem behavior. And as the times have changed with regards to what's considered a politically correct terminology, we've tried to decrease the negativity maybe associated with the behavior because it's clearly not the kid's fault and that's not the parent's fault. And now it's challenging behavior. So it is as broadly defined as behavior that parents are having or teachers are having trouble managing. So at the most basic level, it could be temper tantrums. It could be screaming, crying. For adolescents, it could be passive-aggressive behavior and ignoring you or cursing at you, I suppose. Some of the most common typographies that we see for very young kids are aggressive behavior, hitting, kicking, biting, scratching, pinching, my favorite, spitting. And it moves all the way up to then behaviors that can be self-injurious. And so what I mean by that are behaviors that the child does to themselves. So something might be head banging or face slapping or head hitting. Another very common one is hand biting and hand mouthing. These behaviors actually start to cause tissue damage to themselves. So in the most extreme cases, I've seen kids that have picked their ear off of their head. I've seen kids with prosthetic legs that will swing them up and strike themselves in the forehead. So some really kind of devastating, and I guess at the most extreme level, people have died from infections caused by not getting the wounds taken care of in a timely manner.
So we're talking about a wide range of behaviors that can be exhibited by a wide range of children at different ages, and this is something that at some point any child could show. It would not have to be a child that would have to have chronic behavior disorders or learning disabilities or any particular kind of problem. Just right at the ground floor, you just have to say almost any child at many different points along their development could show these kinds of behaviors, and it could be a problem, could be a serious issue for both parents and teachers to deal with.
That's absolutely true. I mean, my own two children, 11 and 7 years old, although delightful, have exhibited many challenging behaviors towards us over their years. What we see, though, with kids that are typically developing is that the real severe kind of temper tantrums and aggression typically, and I'll say typically, because I know that it's not always true, they go away as the kids get better and better verbal communication abilities. Mm-hmm. So as they learn how to talk, how to walk, how to go get what they want rather than being dependent on people giving them what they want, and their ability to negotiate with the people that control what they want, i.e. parents and teachers, typically they go away. And people then start to get what they want through verbal communication. For the individuals with the most significant developmental disabilities, and some kids may never form formal vocal speech. They may have augmentative communication devices or picture exchange communication or sign, but they have a real difficulty having this kind of very smooth transition between the caregiver and the child about negotiating what they want. Yeah. And so we have found that the best predictors of sustained challenging behavior are the more impaired communication abilities, the more likelihood that it's going to persist, the problem behavior, or the more significant limitations in intellectual abilities. Now, there's also some genetic disorders that are correlated with increased probability of these challenging behaviors, but really it's the communication and intellectual abilities that probably cut across a variety of different developmental disorders.
Yeah. And then probably and an important point to underscore is that, as you say, that probably for many children, that's the kind of thing that as they develop and they grow out of. It is important that it not be something that's ignored. I think I'm sure you would say, other people would say, it's something that you have to pay attention to, because if you see a lot of challenging behaviors in children and those things persist and maybe those things get worse, that can be a predictor of, or at least put them at greater risk for other sorts of problems in their social relationships, difficulties in learning. It may underline that may make mm-hmm. it more likely that they would be involved in the criminal justice system and they grow up. I mean, there are many reasons why, if you see that and it's a big problem, you want to deal with that as soon as you possibly can.
Absolutely. And that's what we're really trying to turn towards is the model that I was trained in 15 years ago was very reactionary, meaning we had experts set up across the country called at different developmental disability center or centers for excellence in developmental disabilities. Around the country, you would wait for the child to exhibit a severe behavior problem, and then they would refer you to an expert and you would treat the problem. And what really helped me change my philosophy was it was a Monday morning. I was at the University of Kansas Medical Center. I was a brand new assistant professor in pediatrics there. And I ran a clinic called the Self-Injurious and Aggressive Behavior Clinic. And I was at my desk, 7 a.m. This is when my kids were still young enough that I could get up and get out the door and get going early in the morning. The phone rings, and it's, you know, not even work hours yet, so I wasn't even going to answer it, but I had dropped my daughter off at the daycare at that time, and it was one of those ones where I was being a bad parent. I knew that a sniffle was coming on, but I had so much to do that day, I just said, you know what, she's not running a fever, I'm going to send her to daycare anyway, even though I know she'll probably give a bunch of other kids a cold. So I wasn't a very good parent that day. But I picked up the phone because I thought it might be the daycare center calling me and telling me to come pick up my kid. And it's a mom, and the mom says, is this Dr. Richmond? And I said, yes, you know, what can I do for you? She said, well, I want to know what kind of person you are and what kind of professional you are that you make children hurt themselves before they're allowed to come see you in your clinic. And I said, well, wait, hold on a second. Yeah, you know, that's not true first. You know, if you want me to see your child. She's like, well, I called into the intake, and I said that my child has just been diagnosed with Angelman syndrome. He's not even a year old yet. He doesn't have any self-injury, any aggression whatsoever. But our developmental pediatrician said, your child is at a significantly increased risk for developing self-injurious behavior. So it scared the mom. So the mom went on Google, typed in self-injurious behavior, and you will see everything from people that are cutting and burning their skin and doing all sorts of behaviors that in the typical developing population are typically associated with a pretty significant psychiatric disorder. So she also saw other pictures of kids destroying themselves and caving their faces in, and she says, you know, and I want you to answer this question. What kind of doctor are you? And so I had to back her back up. And so I told her, you know, come meet with me, and I want to talk with you, because she said, I want you to tell me what I can do to prevent this behavior from even developing in my son. She'll said, I'll be darned, and she didn't use the word darned, I'll be darned if I'm going to sit around and wait for my kid to develop self-injury if I know that he's at an increased risk for doing it. Why wouldn't I start right now, day one, that I know that he's at risk? And I scratched my head, and you know, she kind of had me, right? Mm-hmm. So there wasn't a lot in the literature on prevention of these kind of behavior disorders in kids with typical development or atypical development. And so I thought that she would never call again, right? So I said, you know, here's my email address. Email me if you want to talk to me about this, and I'll have lunch with you. I thought I'd never hear from her. I just hang up the phone. I just clicked it down. And up popped this email from her. Said, I can meet with you for lunch anytime this week. So I met with her. And she's really the one about 12 years ago that forced me to shift my paradigm of thinking about behavior problems. And so I have been chasing that for the last 12 years through several grants and outreach programs where we've gone to kids' homes and tried to do some early intervention and prevention of these behavior problems in really babies with really severe developmental delays.
Well, that I like that story so much because if there's anybody who thinks that there are not parents, and I'm sure that many of them are moms, that are not heroic defenders of their children and are the ones who are really pushing for trying to push the envelope as far as professionals are concerned,
yep.
that shows that. And I'm sure that there are many, many other people, doctors and counselors and teachers, who have had similar kind of experience from parents who said, look, this is not just a request. This is a demand. And it's not that they're saying that they're not willing to do some of the work themselves, but I'm sure that they're saying, look, you've got to tell me
what to do. Yeah, no, I was, I loved her. I thought that this was going to be one of those ladies that you try to run away from. She ended up, her son was the first one enrolled in my early intervention grant for self-injurious behavior. So we wrote a grant. We took her seriously. Matter of fact, after that lunch, I said, well, let's come back and meet with me because I'm going to dig in the literature a little more for you, you know. And I met with her a week later and I said, I've got nothing for you. And so I said, but you know what? I learned enough about it that I've got a great idea for a grant. And we wrote for it. And initially, it got turned down by the National Institutes of Health. They are the ones that predominantly fund this kind of research because it's a medical problem, self-injurious behavior. We got declined initially. And then this is really how universities should work. I then took the same application and turned it into the University of Kansas Research Institute for a pilot seed money. Which is a small internal grant, I can't remember, $20,000 or something like that, for a couple of years to get pilot data to even suggest to the National Institutes of Health that I know what I'm talking about and that my idea for how we might be able to head some of these behaviors off have some merit, at least enough merit that you should give me a little bit of money to see if it should work. After that, we then wrote for a grant. It's called a small grant. It's called an RO3 mechanism that the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, which predominantly funds research for individuals with developmental disabilities, and they funded it, and they loved it. And so we did a mini assessment grant, and now we've just finished a little mini early intervention grant. And the data look strong, but there are still some cases that are extremely treatment resistant. So I would say our success rate is somewhere around maybe 70%. And we define success as decreasing problem behavior by 80% from where it was before. Yeah. So what we do is we do very detailed measurement of how often it's occurring under very specific environmental situations. And then we say at the end of treatment, and after we've somewhat pulled out of the family, meaning we're just kind of serving as a support mechanism and answering questions, rather than really going and teaching them how to interact with their children or how to respond to these behaviors. So I would say that about 70% of our cases have responded with either an 80% or better reduction. But there's always a couple of cases, and these are the most interesting ones, right, that make you scratch your head and say, you know what, this failed for you. As a mom, I got to look you right in the eye and tell you, you know, this treatment is not working for your child. We need to move on and try some other things or add more components. See, when you're doing a research grant, you've got to stick very carefully with what you've said you'll do so that you know that the results are due to what you did with them. If you start just adding in components piecemeal for individual families, at the end you have a very hard time aggregating the data and answering the question, does this seem to help for the majority of kids with self-injurious behavior?
Our guest in this part of Focus is David Richman. He's associate professor of special education here at the U of I, has been for the past few years, and he is now going to be making his way to Texas Tech, to the Burkhart Center for Autism Education and Research. And we're talking about some of the work that he's been involved in here and elsewhere, dealing with children, trying to help children and parents and teachers with challenging behaviors, particularly children who have disabilities, talking about how you can approach treatment and intervention and just how difficult that can be for parents, but what kind of advice and help you can also offer to parents. And questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to go back for a second, I asked right at the beginning about a definition of challenging behavior, and you talked about how different children of different ages can certainly exhibit it. And we can be talking about something like tantrums, which probably all parents have seen, various kinds of aggressive behaviors that are directed to other children, for example. We can have aggression directed towards physical things, towards property. And I'm sure that one might look at a child like that and initially think that this is just sort of pure aggression, that the idea here is the child wants to break something or the child wants to hurt something, someone, and they don't. It's easy not to see that, or it's difficult to see that actually serves a sort of a function. And I know what you've encouraged people to do, and people in this field encourage parents and teachers to do, is try to understand what the child is trying to do here, and that it may indeed go back to the issue of communication,
right,
of them not being able to communicate what they want or they need any other way. So I suppose in some cases, what it is a way of getting attention paid to them. And it seems that for some children, that's the only way that they know, perhaps,
right,
to secure the attention of a parent or a teacher, because I suppose there are some kids for whom negative attention is better than no attention, and that's it. It is in an odd way a kind of communication.
It is, and for the vast majority of cases, it's communication, social. Mm-hmm. And so I'll try to break that down for us. I just got back from talking to about 300 parents at the Cornelia de Lange Syndrome United States Foundation Conference. So Cornelia de Lange Syndrome is an incredibly rare genetic disorder. I can't even tell you probably less than maybe 5,000 cases in the total United States have this genetic disorder. And so that's why they have their own separate conference. And I was in talking to the parents, and I said, you know what? You've heard a lot about functional assessment or functional analysis where you're trying to determine what the function of the problem behavior is. And oftentimes it's portrayed as this incredibly complex assessment methodology where we create analog conditions and we coach you how to interact with your kid for the next 5 minutes. And then we measure how much problem behavior occurs under certain test conditions versus a control condition. And that's what I would call the Mercedes version of the functional analysis. But you don't need the Mercedes version, right? The Yugo version will do just fine. And do they still make Yugos?
But no, we actually talked about that the other day, but that's another subject.
Okay. So I tell parents, and oftentimes the person that's involved in the heat of the battle, of the way I'll describe this, yeah, or the person that's actually doing the interacting with the kid during a tantrum, is probably not the best person to objectively try to judge and watch. They can do it, but oftentimes you're caught up in the moment, right? You're either worried, you're angry, you're upset, you're all of the above. And it really takes somebody sometimes objectively watching it from the sideline, so to speak, and observing it and saying, you know what? And then I ask parents, well, collapse it into three broad categories. One is the one that you just described, and I'm going to call that the gain function. Mm-hmm. That is, give me attention, give me toys, give me cookies, give me a Mercedes. You know, whatever it is that the kid is wanting, it takes another person in the environment to get it for them. All right, so that's a gain function. They're getting something back. So I'll give you an example. This is the 2010 example. Now, I've had to update my examples here. A mom was standing waiting for the elevator at this Cornelia de Lange Syndrome conference, right? She is pecking away on her iPod or her BlackBerry. I don't know which one it was, but there was clearly something very enchanting about what was going on in that little box. She had about a 2 or 3 year old little guy, and I don't think he had the Cornelia de Lange syndrome. I think it was a sibling. And first the sibling or the youngster said, "Mama," got nothing. Then the kid yanked on the mom's pant legs. Remember, the kid's only 3 feet tall. Yanks on the pant leg and says, "Mama," simultaneously. And I'm watching this, you know, yanking it harder and harder and harder. And she would not even acknowledge his presence, right? So eventually, after about 30 seconds, I'm going to guess, he hauls off and just sucker punches her right in the belly, right? She folds over. And then, now, I want you to pay very close attention. Watch what happens next. Mom stops pecking on the BlackBerry, stops pecking on her iPod, looks to him, and screams at him, "How could you hit me? Why would you hit me? Don't hit me. Don't you know it hurts me? What do you need to do besides hit me?" Do you follow the sequence of events, though? Appropriate behavior, ignore. Semi-appropriate behavior, ignore. Aggression
gets the attention.
Attention. So, and I'm not suggesting that parents are sitting there going through some thought process saying, "Air to go, I am going to provide contingent attention to my child's aberrant behavior because I want to reinforce my child's aberrant behavior." Of course not. This is a very natural ebb and flow of laws of behavior that dictate our behavior, all right? Mm-hmm. So this is not something that I think parents sit down and think about, "I'm going to reinforce my child's problem behavior." Of course not. But these very natural teaching strategies, because we're always trying to tell the child what to do, right? We're trying to take an education approach to them. But the problem is the educational approach is done immediately after problem behavior and contingent upon problem behavior. Instead of reprimanding and attempting to do is decrease it, you've actually taught the child what? The next time you really need attention and mom's not available for attention, just go over there and whap her. And all of a sudden, you get your attention that you wanted, right? So that's that gain model. Now, there's another one that's huge that's also social, which is get the heck away from me.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. It can be pay attention to me, or it can also be leave me alone.
You got it. So if I am grading 55 20-page papers for a class, right, I may very much want to escape that behavior, right? And so if I see any opportunity to go do something else or if I could act up or throw the papers off my desk and somebody would send me to time out, I would be more than happy to take that time out as long as I didn't have to complete grading those papers, if that's something that I really wanted to escape. So for a kid, it's more like, go pick up your toys. I told you to pick up your toys. He flops down on the floor and starts squawking. Oftentimes, a very natural approach is to say, "Oh, you're not ready to do it. Why don't you gather yourself, calm down, collect your thoughts, and then come back on over here and do that?" Now, if you still follow through with making the child pick up the toys, that's probably not horrific. But mm-hmm. what they essentially did, though, is to gain a little escape or a break from that demand that you just asked them to do, contingent on flopping and crying. So do you see that it's not that I don't want to give them a break, and it's not that I don't want to give them attention. It's that we have to shift around what we're giving the attention and break for. We've got to shift it around for appropriate communication. Now, the critique I get back from every parent and every teacher is that, but kids can't have what they want all the time. And I 100% agree with you, but I don't know any other way to change the behavior if it's social, meaning it's for gain or escape. I don't know any other way to do it other than to get the child to change the way they're communicating with you. And so for temporary time, and temporary may be 2 days, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, depending on your child, I want you to turn the tables and never give them what they want for their problem behavior and always give it to them what they want for their communication. So if it's going to be that you're going to have to really focus on attention, it's going to have to be a time where you don't have a lot of undivided attention. So a single mom with 5 kids, right, that's pretty difficult to do. So there are some contextual variables in the world that make this science not very applicable because of very limited resources. Mm-hmm. So that's where I get really sad when I see respite care being cut, when I see in-home services being cut, when I see birth-to-3 services being cut. I get really sad because then when moms call me crying and telling me I can't do it, and I need to look them in the eye and say, if I was in your same situation, I don't think I could do it. And that's not something I'm very proud of to do very often. But sometimes I look at their situation and say, I couldn't do it. So why should I continue to ask you to do it? maybe what we need to do is remove some of the parenting stressor variables from you and then come back and see me, and maybe then we can work on this in a little bit more systematic and scientific way.
Yeah. It's really, I just find myself thinking, yes, just how difficult and how challenging it is to be a parent and how many demands there are you and on you. And even if you only had one child, and just, I'm sure many parents would say, you know, it's what you're asking me. I understand what you're asking me to do. And I understand that what you're asking is, when confronted with a situation, I have to at least take a second to sort of step back and say, okay, now wait a minute. And think about what would be my immediate first response, but then maybe think, well, now maybe that was not the best thing to do, the immediate first response. What it really would be a better response here, and that's very, you know, when you're in that situation, and maybe you're thinking about a bunch of other stuff, and you're tired and you're stressed, and it's very difficult. And that, of course, is the time that the child picks to act out. That's really tough.
You hit the nail on top of the head. I only made 3 points in an hour-long talk to these hundreds of parents at the Cornelia de Lange Syndrome Conference. We've now hit on 2 of them. The second point was, know when to give in right away and know when not to make requests. Here's what I'm getting at. If you have to be out the door or in the grocery store or out of some place in the next 5 minutes, you cannot start a request that you need to carry through with if your child starts to engage in problem behavior, right? Because if we make a request and we try to ride it out, right? We say, no, you know, I'm going to wait for you to pick up that toy and you need to get going on it. If you have to be out the door and you wait them out for 5-10 minutes and they're there flopping on the floor screaming and crying, and then you say, you know what, we got to get going, so don't worry about the toys, and you pick them up on your arm and you put them in the minivan. The problem is you taught that child to ride out the request 5-10 minutes, maybe a half hour. Do you see how not on purpose, we can teach children to sustain your tantrum or problem behavior in order to get what you want? So I've told parents, if you slip up and make a request and you know darn well that you don't have the stamina, the wherewithal, or the time to really implement what should be done to get your child to do that, don't ask or give in right away, because then the kid learns, well, most of the time when mom starts down the path of really requiring me to do it, she always falls through. But sometimes she'll back off me right away. Mm-hmm. And so that way we at least don't teach them to maintain challenging behavior for a very long period of time. So the worst thing you can do is ride out a tantrum and then can't ride it out anymore and then give in and give them what they want to get them to be quiet. That is the absolute worst case scenario. It's better to either not ask at all, it's the best, or give in right away.
Our guest in this hour of focus is David Richman. He is associate professor of special education at University of Illinois, has been now for a number of years. He's making his way soon to Texas. He's going to head up the Burkhart Center for Autism Education and Research at Texas Tech. And we're talking about challenging behaviors, what those are, how parents can deal with them, and how particularly they can become problematic in children who have, in addition to showing those kinds of behaviors, maybe have some disabilities, developmental or learning issues. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, we talked a little bit about how sometimes these behaviors can serve or can be understood as a strange but understandable attempt at communication. You know, mm-hmm. It may indeed be about something give me something that I want, or it may be actually escaping something that I don't want to do. I'm interested, you talked earlier about the fact that there are, so those are things that are in a sense kind of outer directed, in
social.
Sense that the target is outside the person. But I'm interested in hearing some more about this issue of children who harm themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, that can be a really, really, have really serious consequences to the health of the child. Now, these other things, I guess I can, they're a little bit easier to understand what the motivation, what the goal of those behaviors might be. And if you look at these kind of behaviors in the same way, you have to say, well, there's got to be some function here. There's got to be, it has to get the child something.
Mm-hmm.
That's really difficult to understand. Well, what would that be? I mean, what underlies that kind of behavior?
Well, I think I'd start off by saying that even self-injurious behavior, so even kids when they slap themselves in the face or bang their head on the table and cause pretty significant pain and discomfort and tissue damage to themselves, even those behaviors can be social. Those too can be to get mom or caregiver's attention. Mm-hmm. They can say, bring over something else. I'm bored and I want to be entertained. Bring me a new toy. So those behaviors, although it doesn't make intuitive sense to us, why would somebody withstand pain to themselves? But let me turn this around to you, all right? So mm-hmm. let's say I drop you off in a foreign country. You have no ability to speak that language. You cannot communicate any other way. Can you imagine yourself getting frustrated or hungry enough or cold enough or tired enough that you would eventually start to do some things that would look very bizarre in that culture? And I guess that's what I'm asking you to understand is that these people sometimes, you know, and once again, we're not talking about the majority of people with disabilities here. Mm-hmm. These individuals sometimes can be have such limited abilities to get what they want any other way that they will take the pain, they will take the scarring in order to get what they want. There is some hypothesis out there that some children don't have the same sensation. They don't feel the same pain. That's been greatly dismissed, except for the most rarest of cases where somebody may have some nerve damage or something like that. But the vast majority of cases of self-injurious behavior still are socially mediated. There's for those two big functions, gain and escape. Now, there's a third function we haven't talked about, and this one is referred to as automatic, or what might be referred to as non-socially mediated. These are big words that mean that there is something about the behavior itself that engaging in the behavior produces the reinforcer that keeps it going. So now let's put it down in plain old language. If you bounce your leg up and down, sometimes when you're nervous or sometimes when you're preoccupied and you catch yourself with your leg bouncing up and down, or you twirl and play with your hair, or my wife, my lovely bride of 14 years, sometimes she will poke at a cuticle and she will say that it hurts when I poke at that little sore spot, but when I release, it feels good. There's an actual pleasurable sensation that's produced after I pick at the cuticle, because I've often wondered, why do you do that? There's a little wound on your finger. Why would you continue to pick at it? So do you see that these behaviors, when they do them, there's some sort of maybe vestibular stimulation, something that they feel that is something that feels good to them or is pleasurable or reinforcing. Or the other thing is sometimes you can, if you scratch where it itches, the itch goes away for a little bit, right? So you can avoid some unpleasant sensory stuff, meaning that it itches and I want to avoid that, so I scratch. By the way, don't do that, right? You just make it worse. You scratch it and you produce more tissue wear down and then it itches more. Go get lotion. So I think that this other big broad category, automatic, is very difficult to understand because it is there. That doesn't don't think about it as nobody else has to be in the room for them to get what they're looking for. Some kids rock to produce more stimulation because they're really, really bored and nothing's going on. But that same exact behavior in that same exact child, he may rock sometimes when there's too much stimulation because he can kind of focus in on the rocking and shut out the rest of the stimulation. So if you're in a very loud and crowded room, you and I get up and stand up and walk out when we get, and it's too much for us, right? It's too much. I can't take it anymore. It's giving me a headache. We turn and we walk out. Well, some individuals with disabilities don't have that ability to do that, right? They're there. They're based on a caregiver is there, and they may be in a wheelchair and can't get out, right? So they may then engage in some repetitive behaviors that allows them to shut out noxious environment by focusing in on their stereotypy. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example. But that automatic one is very difficult to treat because you essentially have to find something else that will replace it. So if somebody mouths their hand, the first thing you've got to figure out, is it stimulation to the mouth, stimulation to the hand, or stimulation to both that might be reinforcing and keeping that behavior going? And then you might try to find some sort of stimulation for the hand, mouth, or both, something to chew on, something to manipulate and feel and hold in the hands that might produce a similar type of sensory feedback that they were getting by engaging in the behavior of mouthing their hand before.
Yeah, and is it always possible for you to find some more more acceptable behavior to substitute that will provide the same kind of stimulation?
No, it's really hard. Yeah, very, very difficult to do. And because most of the time what we do is we take a guess. We say, okay, it looks like they're doing it to stimulate their hand. Let's get them a vibratory ball and mm-hmm. or a koosh ball. And we just kind of shoot from our hip and try. There are ways of actually doing some really nice detailed analyses that will increase the probability of you getting something that will compete with that sensory stimulation. Mm-hmm. But some people have argued that the effort it takes to do that assessment, sometimes it might be better just to keep trying sensory stimulation type toys that might find one that eventually competes with it. So there's two things. One would replace the sensory stimulation. It'd be identical or very close. The other one might just be that it competes. So give you an example. I might really want your attention and I might be willing to tantrum to get your attention. But if you hand me the new iPad, that may hold me over for a long time because I'm surfing the internet and doing my thing. Eventually, I'm going to come back to you and want your attention, but that iPad may hold me over for a good month. Matter of fact, if you have one for me as a little parting gift from the University of Illinois, I'd take it.
Let's see what we can do about that. Our guest in this part of Focus is David Bridgman. He is has now for a number of years been an associate professor of special education here at the U of I. He's making his way to Texas Tech, to the Burkhart Center for Autism Education, to continue this the kind of work that he's been doing here and elsewhere now for a number of years, helping children and parents and teachers with challenging behaviors. Now, questions are certainly welcome. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. If again we're coming back to the issue that for some of these children, what this is, what some of these behaviors are maybe a less positive as far as the parents and the teachers are concerned, but for them, functional kind of communication, how is it actually possible to teach them alternative ways of communicating what they want? I suppose that for some children the answer would be yes, and that for other kids, depending on where they are developmentally, that actually might not be the case.
You know, there's always an exception, because whenever I say always, there'll be an exception. But I have never had the privilege of meeting an individual that had so severe of disabilities that I couldn't teach them to communicate in a different way. Not one. Zero, right? So individuals that have been labeled with severe, profound intellectual disabilities used to be referred to as mental retardation. I have been able to get them to use a very simple, what's called Big Mac micro switch. You know, it's about this big, about the size, let's see, nobody can see us, we're on radio, about the size of a Big Mac hamburger, and it's called the Big Mac micro switch. You hit it, depress it, and it produces, it's got a little tape recorder that you've already taped in there, a message, come play with me, or back off of me, I don't want to work right now, I want a break. Or it might say, bring me some other toys, this is really boring. Mm-hmm. So I have, if they can, so far I've, it's only cause effect, right? You touch this switch and people come over and give you things. And I have yet, and I'm sure somebody will then bring me somebody that I can't and I'll fail, but I have yet in 16 years met an individual that I couldn't teach to communicate in a different way. It may be a very rudimentary system, such as touching a card or touching one switch. But do you see if they're using self-injurious behavior to get that one thing, and I can teach them to touch a switch to get that one thing, I've changed the way that they're communicating with their providers. And then we need to teach them to tolerate delays. And that's easier said than done, but that's another whole hour of interview.
Well, I think that's – I have a caller here, but I think that's really interesting. And it's something that we have talked about before, that is there are a lot of really interesting ways that technology is being applied to help people who have difficulties communicating across a wide range of difficulties, and that it can make an amazing difference, particularly for kids and adolescents, in them being able to interact with their peers, mm-hmm. And to be able to have, I'm sure, relations with teachers and parents. But I'm sure particularly it is important with them being able to communicate with other kids.
And I just want to slide this in. It's not just kids. I've seen 40-year-old adults that have never had any formal communication system whatsoever, mm-hmm. and we've been able to teach them to communicate for what they want. Yeah. So right. It's not just for kids.
Let's talk with – we have a caller here in Urbana. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, yeah, I'm a social worker and a therapist here in Urbana, and I wanted to say I really appreciate what you're talking about and how you're saying a lot of things, because a lot of parents I work with have similar issues for their kids. I'm actually a practitioner of Nurtured Heart, which talks a lot about these same kind of issues. And I was just wondering if you had any books or resources that you could recommend that I could give to some of my parents, because sometimes they just need like a handout or something to take home that can kind of help them remember things.
Absolutely. And the best thing is that this book is written by the internationally renowned expert in what I call behavioral phenotypes, which is different types of patterns of behavior associated with different mm-hmm. genetic syndromes.
Right.
And it's free. So here's where I want you and the listeners to go to. I want you to go to, actually, I don't think I know the exact website. Type into mm-hmm. Google CDLS. It's the abbreviation for Cornelia de Lange syndrome, CDLS, USA Foundation. Just type that into Google. You're going to go to their webpage. You're going to then take one of the links that goes to publications or scientific publications or something like that. You're going to find a PDF there that is written by Chris Oliver, and it says, Self-Injurious Behavior, a Guide for Parents and Carers. And it's written by a gentleman over at in the UK, so it'll have all sorts of funny spellings in there for you. Even behavior will be spelled differently. But it is about a 111-page PDF document that is written in just plain old English. You know, it's part of the barrier is that we talk in jargon. And when we talk in jargon, we immediately alienate a lot of parents and a lot of professionals, you know, because we talk in this language that is our own. Now, this is written for only parents and only carers, and it is cleaned up of scientific jargon, yet is still very scientifically accurate. So while some people may be scratching their head and saying, you know what, my kid doesn't have Cornelia de Lange syndrome, why would that quack tell me to go get that book? Well, the functional approach works for all kids, all individuals, meaning I can't say that it's going to work and treat your child and reduce the problem behavior, but it's a scientifically evidence-based best practice for approaching behavior problems. And the methodology of doing a functional assessment cuts across all individuals, meaning you don't do a functional assessment really all that much different for somebody with Cornelia de Lange than you would for somebody with Down syndrome or autism. Now, you're going to want to take different organism variables into account when you're setting up your observations. Of course, you want to know what genetic syndrome they have or what type of disability they have. But the approach is exactly the same. And so if you go to the CDLS Foundation, United States, because there is an international one and a couple other ones, you're going to go to something like publications and you'll find it. And if people are having trouble finding it, I'll make sure that I email the URL or the link to it to make sure that people can access it.
Okay, great. And thank you for mentioning that it's best practice as well, because that's always important to try and help for funding for a local agency. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
Thanks for the call. Okay. Others are welcome. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is David Richman, Associate Professor of Special Ed here at the U of I, going on to Texas Tech, to the Burkhardt Center for Autism Education and Research. We're talking about challenging behaviors and how parents can help kids who show them. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455.
David, if we have just a moment, can I put in a shameless plug here?
Absolutely.
Okay. There is something there's something going on here in the community that I'm pretty sure most people probably listening to this know about, but just in case there's one out there that doesn't. Mm-hmm. The new YMCA that's going to be built here in sometime in the future, and I don't know when, is going to have something called the Larkins Place. Now, David, have you heard of this, the Larkins Place?
I believe that I have. I think I've come across it just in having read some to get ready for.
Here's what
us
I'd recommend for
here,
you. Yeah. I think you should probably get Amy Armstrong in here. And Amy Armstrong is a mom. And she is a mom that is a community activist. And she is spearheading raising of funds to have a section of the YMCA building built with universal design principles, so it will be non-exclusionary. It's not just for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. It's for everybody. But it's going to be built so people with all different kinds of abilities can use it and access it. And there's going to be resource center there for families of kids with disabilities. There's going to be maybe a warm water therapy pool. There's going to be, right now, there are very few places that moms tell me they can, and dads, can take their children with disabilities and feel like they're safe, meaning that there's not wood chips lying around that they might accidentally pick up or fall and get splinters. And so these people tend to be very medically, some of them, medically fragile. And we have to make sure that they're in a very kind of safe and warm and welcoming environment. And so if anybody is out there that is looking for a cause, the Larkin's Place will change the face of Champaign and Urbana with regards to families and support for people with in Peru. I just got back from Peru. They now refer to them as people with different abilities. And I kind of like that, right? So it's not necessarily that they're we always focus on what's wrong, the disability. In Lima, Peru, they take a very different approach. They say, I don't want to talk about what the kid's disability is. What's the what can the kid do? tell me no more about what the kid can't do. Name me one thing that the kid can do, and that's where we're going to start, and that's where we're going to find a job for them, and that's where we're going to work on for the next 15 years to get them ready to go out into the community and work. I really like that approach. I'm not a big PC guy, meaning I don't believe that we just continue to change terms every time somebody decides they don't like the term, right? Mm-hmm. I think that creates problems in communication in the scientific literature if we keep changing the terminologies, you know, the official ones. But when I speak colloquially, I really like the term different abilities. So these are people with different abilities, not disabilities. I love it.
All right, very good. Well, if somebody wants to call in real quick, in fact, we have another caller here, and they're also in Urbana, so let's talk with them. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having Dr. Richmond on. I am a early interventionist therapist. I do work with a variety of children, and I have a behavior I've never come across. I wouldn't call it self-injurious, but little guy likes to puddle his drool and watch it, and mom is just in a tizzy, starting to ruin the rugs, and, you know, he does it anywhere, anytime. I've seen it during therapy when he's kind of at the end of the, you know, he's had his time, he's stayed engaged, he's been interested. And then he just needs a break. Do
yeah.
you have any idea where I can find some information on it?
I'm not so sure I can lead you to a really good resource, but let me shoot from the hip for a second, if you'll allow me to. I've seen a lot of kids engage in this behavior. I call it spittle play, a very technical term. And typically what we've done in the past is we have tried to figure out a way that we can simulate the same feeling, whether it's watching it or the visual stimulation of watching it drip out of his mouth onto a mirror or something like that, or whether it's the feeling in the hands of the play. So what we usually start with is like a plate, put a bunch of shaving cream or something on there and see if he'll play with the shaving cream or maybe another substance and watch it drip down onto the plate or a mirror or something like that. So the only thing I can tell you is that, you know, you'd first have to eyeball it and rule out that he's doing it to get a reaction from you or doing it to get you to quit therapy. I mean, we want to rule those kind of things out. My hunch is that it's not due to either one of those reasons. It's maintained by some sort of automatic reinforcement. And the only place I can suggest is if we've got to find something that is somewhat similar in sensory properties to the saliva that's coming out of his mouth and give him another way to do it. And then when he does the spittle play, we block it. That's typically what we do for treatment.
Yeah, we've been blocking it. And an alternative, it seems to be the visual. He doesn't touch it at all.
Hmm.
It seems to be over a variety of services that are rounded,
yeah.
or flat, you know, so sometimes it goes fast.
Yep, you may have a really hard time then finding something to replace that's appropriate. And when I'm stuck with those kind of situations, what I do is take a path of least resistance, and I say, you know what, that's a preferred activity for that kid. It's probably, if he learns to do it in a safe and clean way, not going to harm him or the carpets if we can teach him when and where and under what conditions he can do it. So let me say it in another way. We might have a card out during therapy that shows a sign with spit coming down out of his mouth and a big X through it. And every time that he does that, we're going to clean it up. We're going to wipe it off. We're not going to allow him to see it drip. And we're going to block it. We're going to block his mouth from it dripping down, whatever we have to do. But then we're going to also show him another stimulus card. And the card maybe shows him with spit falling down out of his mouth. If we can teach kids to only do it under very specific situations, then I sometimes say, you know what, why fight it and try to get rid of it? Let's use it almost as a reinforcer to say, you know what, you need to get through these sessions, you need to get through this time without engaging in that behavior at all. And then if you want 5 or 10 minutes to do it in a clean and healthy way, go over there and do it over there in the corner by the sink and then clean up when you're done. So that's the best I can do for you. It's probably not all that helpful.
It was. I totally followed what you had to say, and I appreciate your information. Thank you.
Okay,
absolutely.
Thank you. I suppose that just, I don't know if this is a strange observation, but I guess it does make me think that probably that all people, adults included, maybe engage in some behaviors that are appropriate in some circumstances and not appropriate in others. And part of the deal is learning when you can do it and when you can't.
You got it. We do the same thing with adults with intellectual disabilities that are masturbating in inappropriate places. It's not that they're trying to offend people. It's not that they're trying to make a spectacle out of it. They don't want people watching them do it that. They don't know where and when they can do it and when they can't do it. Nothing wrong with masturbation, but you need to do it in the privacy of your own home, in the privacy of your own bathroom, or wherever you do it. So to me, it's a teaching problem, not necessarily a problem for the child.
Well, we're at the point here, we pretty much have to finish. Maybe we have about a minute. And I guess I'm just interested in any sort of last thoughts you might leave, particularly for parents who maybe face this at a more more occasional and sort of lower level kind of than we're talking about here.
Yeah, no, I think if we can take the approach that problem behavior is not something that comes from within your child. It is a social problem. It happens in the environment. We are involved with it. Don't blame the child. Don't blame the kid. Don't blame the student. Take actually a very different approach and say, what is it about the environment that seems to be setting that child up to do that behavior? And what is it that we could do to decrease the triggers? And how can we respond to it in a way that won't make it worse or keep it going in the future?
Yeah, all right. Well, at that, we'll have to finish up. Our guest in this hour of Focus, David Richman. He is Associate Professor of Special Education here. Is still officially now here at the U of I?
Until August 15th. Yeah. I am still an employee of the University of Illinois.
All right. And then we'll be going to the Burkhart Center for Autism Education and Research at Texas Tech University. Thank you very much.
David, it's my pleasure to meet you.